I got a one-show job performing near the Russian River in Northern California. I drove there in my second great car, a yellow 1966 Ford Mustang. My third and last great car was a yellow 1967 Jaguar XKE. Then I lost all interest in cars. Up north, I reconnoitered with Mitzi and she took photos of me canoeing. Unfortunately, she didn't photograph the job I had, performing at a drive-in theater at 3 p.m. under the afternoon sun, while a dozen cars hooked up to the sound system listened through window speakers. If the drive-in patrons thought a joke was funny, they honked. You might think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. Once on the way to the Trumbo house, Mitzi warned me, "Pop's in a bad mood today. He's got a screenplay due in 4 days and he hasn't started it yet." The screenplay was for the movie The Fixer, starring Alan Bates. Eventually the work got done and the movie was ready to shoot. Trumbo encouraged Mitzi to join him, and she was whisked off to Budapest for the duration of the film. After I received several charming letters from her and then noticed a lag in the regularity of their arrival, Mitzi sent me a gentle and direct Dear John letter. She had been swept away by the director John Frankenheimer, who, 20 years later, tried and failed to seduce my then-wife, the actress Victoria Tennant, whom he was directing in a movie. Mitzi was simply too alluring to be left alone in a foreign country, and I was too hormonal to be left alone in Hollywood. Incidentally, Frankenheimer died a few years ago, but it was not I who killed him. Television. I was still 21 when I was politely booted from Randy and Diane Sparks' garage apartment. I moved to an unincorporated area called Palms, adjacent to the historic MGM Studios, and shared a small guest house with the sharp, deadpan comedian Gary Muldeer, I think we should put pictures of missing transvestites on cartons of Half and Half, and the lonely voice singer-guitarist Michael Johnson. I continued to work at Ledbetter's and attend classes at UCLA. But while I studied half-heartedly in Westwood, Nina had entered the world of real show business. She had changed her name to the more mellifluous Nina Lawrence and landed a job dancing on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, the hippest thing on television and flower-powered all over the place. She had begun dating Mason Williams, the head writer on the show. I still had an affectionate crush on her and was glad for her and sick all at the same time. Mason Williams, exuberant, infused with creativity, and the future composer of the smash hit Classical Gas, drove an elegant 1938 Pierce Arrow and could talk the new aesthetic, essentially the appreciation for all things quirky and creative, much better than I could. Where I could only recite poetry, Mason actually was a poet. He lived in a rented house in the Hollywood Hills with sparkling views of Los Angeles out the bedroom's vast picture window. I imagined Mason and Nina doing it every which away for anyone with a pair of binoculars to see. But these days, who could mind? We weren't a couple anymore, and free love, man, free love, which, by the way, was the single greatest concept a young man has ever heard. There was a time when intercourse, or some version of it, was a way of saying hello. About 3 years later, women got wise, and my frustration returned to normal levels. I was almost but not quite in a financial bind when Nina phoned me to say that the Smothers Brothers, exercising the slogan of the day, "Never trust anyone over 30, wanted to experiment and hire a few young writers for their hit TV show. In college, influenced by Jack Douglas's book, My Brother Was an Only Child, and Mason Williams, The Mason Williams Reading Matter, I had composed, as a defiant alternative to coherent essay writing, some goofy one-paragraph stories with such titles as The Day the Dopes Came Over, What to Say When the Ducks Show Up, and Cruel Shoes. Nina told me to send over my stories. I did, and she gave them to Mason. The collection of scraps I sent was sketchy, half-baked material that I would never have submitted to a college English class for fear of expulsion. But Mason liked it, or maybe he just liked Nina, and having never written anything professionally in my life, I was hired as a tryout for the few remaining weeks of the Smothers season. I gingerly went to my television writing instructor at UCLA and told him I had to resign from the class and school because I had gotten a job writing for television. Years later, I learned that because my material had not made it past the final judges at the top, Mason, in an act of artistic generosity, had paid this newcomer out of his own pocket. My professional writing career started off painfully. The older writers were rightfully suspicious of this kid, especially since my only qualification was being under 30, and I felt the pressure to deliver. I was timid and unsure of myself in this suddenly wider world. If I was asked to write an intro for the folk singer Judy Collins, I would write, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's folk singer Judy Collins." One afternoon, I was in the studio, watching a rehearsal of a sketch dealing with television. Tommy Smothers came up to me and said directly, "We need an intro for this bit. Can you write it?" This question was put to me with a clear implication that my job was on the line. I said yes, but meant no. I went upstairs to my office as if I were on a march to the gallows. My mind was blank, blanker than blank. I was a tabula rasa. I put paper in the typewriter and impotently stared at it. Finally, a great line occurred to me, except it belonged to my roommate, the comedian Gary Muledeer. But it was perfect for this intro, so why not call him and ask if I could use it? By a miracle, he was home. I explained that I was stuck. He said, "Sure, use it." I went downstairs, handed in the line, and Dick Smothers read the joke. "It has been proven that more Americans watch television than any other appliance." Two highly experienced writers, Hal Goodman and Al Goldman, with credits extending back to Jack Benny, came up to me and said, "Did you write that joke?" "Yes," I said. "Good work," they said. If at that moment I had been hooked up to a lie detector, it would have spewed smoke. The event must have been cathartic, because afterward I relaxed, and I was able to contribute fully to the show. The season ended, and I was asked to work on a summer replacement show, the malappropriately titled The Summer Brothers Smother Show, starring Glenn Campbell. Glenn was a former studio musician who had just risen to stardom with his first big hit, John Hartford's Gentle on My Mind. I was 22 years old when I found myself standing in a small room at CBS on Fairfax with a few other writers, including John Hartford, while Pete Seeger strummed his banjo not 5 feet from me. Around the calfskin head of Pete's banjo was written in ink, "This machine surrounds hate and forces it to surrender," an allusion to Woody Guthrie's earlier guitar slogan, "This machine kills fascists." We pitched concepts for Pete's appearance, but his idea was the best. He would sing "Waist Deep in the Big Muddy" and "The Big Fool Says to Push On" over images of the increasingly tragic war in Vietnam. Glenn Campbell probably hadn't known what he was getting into, but he endorsed us all the way. I was teamed with the hilarious Bob Einstein, an advertising writer who had found his way to CBS, and fortunately, as we shared a windowless office and worked together 14 hours a day, we became inseparable friends. Bob and I were perfect writing foils. We had a mutual regard for Laurel and Hardy, Jerry Lewis, Daffy Duck, and Mel Blanc's peculiar genius, and we could make each other laugh until we were breathless. If I accidentally banged my head on a stage pipe, Bob would collapse in hysterics, and following his lead, so would I. At least 8 of our 14 hours were spent laughing until we were in pain, then trying to decide if what we were laughing at was usable or just comic delirium. Bob later achieved fame as Super Dave, a bumbling TV daredevil. Though Bob and I were a team, I sometimes worked with another young writer-performer, Rob Reiner, later to make his mark as the director of, among other films, When Harry Met Sally and the classic This Is Spinal Tap. Rob, in a coincidence that was yet to happen, was the son of my future film director, Carl Reiner. Rob and I closed our first season with a strong finish. We wrote a 10-minute finale combining short sketches with classic rock songs from the 50s. At that time, Oldies But Goodies was a new concept. The segment was a hit, and Rob and I gave ourselves credit, whether it was accurate or not, for starting a 50s music revival. We wrote it for Glenn Campbell and Bobby Gentry, who was still writing on the success of Ode to Billy Joe. And when Bobby appeared on stage in an itsy-bitsy teeny-weeny yellow polka-dot bikini, all the writers' jaws dropped. We hadn't known she started as a chorus girl in Las Vegas. I had a short-lived but troublesome worry. What if writing comedy was a dead end because one day everything would have been done and we writers would just run out of stuff? I assuaged myself with my own homegrown homily. Comedy is a distortion of what is happening, and there will always be something happening. This problem solved, I grew more confident as a writer and slid into steady work the following season, thanks to an endorsement from Bob Einstein on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. I even had a few walk-on appearances where I inevitably played the hippie. The satirical show had taken a big left turn, which suited my politics perfectly. Constantly making news because of CBS's censorship policy, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour was the only source on primetime television for both satire and contemporary music acts such as The Doors and The Beatles. Though my new writing job frequently required all-nighters, I continued to service my stand-up career. I would bomb regularly at the Ice House, but the audiences were so sparse that the proprietor, Bob Stain, couldn't tell if I was flopping or the house was too empty. One night I realized I had been on for 20 minutes and had not gotten a single laugh from the dead Tuesday night crowd. I thought, why not go for the record? I set my mind to it and finished the show without having roused one snicker. However, there was a sign of encouragement from these early jobs, and years later I heard it phrased perfectly by Bill Cosby. He said that early in his career, when the audience wasn't laughing, he could hear the waitresses laughing, and they saw the show night after night. I noticed that the waitresses were laughing. My life had been alternately inching or leaping upward. I was proud of my job on the Smothers Brothers show. I had some cash. My sex life was abundant and selfish. Things were rolling along nicely when I experienced a crushing psychological surprise. One night I was off to the movies with my friends John McClure, George McKelvey, and his wife Carol. We were going to see Mel Brooks's The Producers, and we decided to smoke a little pot, which had become a dietary staple for me. So now I was high. In the car on the way to the theater, I felt my mind being torn from its present location and lifted into the ether. My discomfort intensified, and I experienced an eerie distancing from my own self that crystallized into morbid doom. I mutely waited for the feeling to pass. It didn't. And I finally said, I feel strange. We got out of the car, and John, George, and Carol walked me along Sunset Boulevard in the night. I decided to go into the theater, thinking it might be distracting. During the film, I sat in stoic silence as my heart began to race above 200 beats per minute, and the saliva drained from my mouth so completely that I could not move my tongue. I assumed this was the heart attack I had been waiting for, though I wasn't feeling pain. I was, however, experiencing extreme fear. I thought I was dying, and I can't explain to you why I just sat there. After the movie, I considered checking myself into a hospital, but if I went to a hospital, I would miss work the next day, which might make me expendable at CBS, where my career was just launching. My friends walked me along Sunset again, and I remember humming, "Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune," from The King and I. I spent the night on George and Carol's couch in absolute terror. I kept wondering, am I dying, but was more concerned with the question, do I have to quit my job? I survived the night and struggled into work the next morning. I was not relieved, but I was calmer. I confessed to Bob Einstein what had happened, and found that as soon as I discussed the symptoms, they arose again with full intensity. However, I somehow maintained my implacable facade. The cycle was unbreakable. Any relief was followed by the worry of recurrence, which itself provoked the symptoms. After a few weeks, a list of triggers developed. I couldn't go back into a movie theater, and I didn't for at least 10 years. I never smoked pot again or got involved in the era's preoccupation with illicit substances. I'm sure this event helped me avoid the scourge of cocaine. However, the worst trigger was a certain event that, cruelly, happened every day. It was night. Eventually, I could find my way through the daytime, but as I left work, winding my way up the canyon streets as the sun set, I imagined feeling the slight rise in elevation and the air getting thinner. Nuts, I know. As a teenager, I had mixed a somber home life with a jubilant life away from the house. Now I could be funny, alert, and involved while nursing internal chaos, believing that death was inching near with each eroding episode of terror. I learned over the next few months that I could do several things at once, be a comedy writer, be a stand-up comedian, and endure private, mortal fear. Thankfully, after a difficult year, my specific dread of nightfall faded. I suppose I was too practical to have such an inconvenient phobia. I discovered there was a name for what was happening to me. Reading medical and psychology books, I found my symptoms exactly described and named as an anxiety attack. I felt a sense of relief from the simple understanding that I was not alone. I read that these panic attacks were not dangerous, just gravely unpleasant. The symptoms were comparable to the biological changes the body experiences when put in danger, as if you were standing in front of an object of fear, such as an unleashed lion. In an anxiety attack, you have all of the symptoms of fear, yet there is no lion. I could not let self-doubt or lack of talent cause me to fail at this new writing job, this lion, which was the gateway to my next life as an entertainer. I carefully buried this fear. I was in over my head, but my conscious mind wouldn't allow that thought to exist, and my body rebelled that night in the movie theater. At least, this is my 10-cent diagnosis. I continued to suffer the attacks while I went on with my work, refusing to let this inner nightmare affect my performing or writing career. Though panic attacks are gone from my life now, they receded as slowly as the ice around Greenland. They were woven throughout 2 decades of my life. When I think of the moments of elation I have experienced over some of my successes, I am astounded at the number of times they have been accompanied by elation's hellish opposite.